This is Geek Speak, episode 41 of season 16. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the studio is Miles Elam. He's a software engineer, pedant, curmudgeon, and political junkie. Hi, Miles.
How's it going?
Quite well, thank you. And it's been a while, quite a while, actually. Mr. Ben Jaffe, a programmer, musician, video geek, and world traveler.
Hello, hello. Hi. Yes, Miles is a pedant and curmudgeon. I haven't heard this new intro.
We've been doing it for a while.
It's good, yeah.
And also remote, Dee Dee Hubbard, software engineer, working in the clouds, and roller derby nerd. Hi, Dee Dee.
Coming at you from the cloud right now.
We are going to step right into the geek news, but first I want to mention, well, we don't actually have a correction, but we have a story that ongoes this. Last week we talked about hacking the iPhone 7 to give it an iPhone head jack, a 2.5 millimeter
actually,
headphone jack.
So a three and a half millimeter.
3.5 millimeter.
Yeah,
jack.
And that, of course, I know my standards.
Did you hear about that?
So something you should know. I actually just got an iPhone 7, and I drilled into it, and sure enough, it broke my iPhone 7. So yeah, people were saying, oh, hey, you want a headphone jack? Just drill in this very specific location a hole for the headphones, and then it'll work. Of course, that's not going to work. So, but...
And just to clarify, you didn't actually do this.
I did not. I don't have an iPhone.
Yes, you were giving the impression that you were sufficiently foolish.
Comedic value, yes. But there is an Indiegogo campaign to bring the headphone jack to the iPhone 7, not by drilling into it, but by putting a case on it.
Oh.
So you know how a lot of times people will put those cases on their phones where the case has a built-in battery, and so you get extra battery life and all that stuff, and it's really, really nice to do if you actually use your phone during the day, given that you just run out of battery. This one has so it plugs into the – is it called the Lightning port?
It is called the Lightning port, yeah.
Yeah, so it plugs into the Lightning port. And it charges it that way, and it also connects it up to a headphone jack that's in the actual case. So you can plug in a normal headphone jack, the headphones that you already have and own, without going and buying a dongle from Apple for $50 or something like that.
And it's always with your phone, which is kind of nice, because one of the problems with those dongles is it might not be. You're saying that you can charge it and use the iPhone jack. Does it also have a battery in this case?
There's a battery built in.
Kind of the best of both worlds.
So you get better battery, you get all of that stuff. So it's an Indiegogo thing. If there was anything that I would want to push, it's something like this, because I really dislike the choices that Apple makes in this department, in the mobile department.
Of course, since you're an Amazon, since you're an Android user, does it really matter?
I would never buy an Amazon phone.
Speaking of Amazon, accidentally, what's going on with Amazon, Miles?
Something that I've noticed for quite a while, I'm sure you will have as well, is when you go to Amazon, you look at the reviews. There will be several out there for a product that says, here is my honest review. I was given this product or sold at a discount in order for a fair and honest in exchange for a fair and honest review.
I did that with nail clippers, actually. Yeah, I bought some nail clippers, and then it came with a little card, and it said, hey, do you want another pair of nail clippers? Just leave a review and, you know, contact us via email. And sure enough, I got it.
Was that Amazon's Vine program?
I don't know. Nah.
At any rate,
so that's actually how that happens. That's how the loop happens. You get something from them, and then you then participate.
Yeah, and then you get something additional as a result.
Well, it depends on how it's going. If it's through Amazon and their Vine program, it'll keep going. But if it's not, if it's through other resellers, it's going to stop.
Oh, interesting.
Like, what was happening?
Is Amazon stopping it?
Yes. Amazon is going to ban them. What they are finding is that there is a deviation from the norm with regard to these quote unquote unbiased reviews. Now, the companies may be saying, hey, this is an unbiased review. We don't want to sway you. We want an unbiased review.
Yeah, they'll say that.
However, the individual person that is reviewing the item may be getting free or discounted items on a regular basis. And there may be a psychological aspect, even if it's unconscious, to saying –
there's a psychological aspect of this. I mean, absolutely. Right, yeah. You're a human.
To say, like, I still want to get stuff, so I don't want to totally badmouth this product.
No, I think I was fair and unbiased. I just love that nail clipper company. They're really nice nail clippers. I'm not going to say what brand it was.
Wait, I really have to know something.
I clipped my nails on the walk over
here. Really, like, when you were getting those nail clippers, were you like, oh yeah, I'm going to review these things? Or did the card help you make the review?
Well, no. So they did say, they didn't put any words in my mouth or anything like that, but I did feel that I had a positive feeling towards their customer service, towards the tone of the text of the copy on the card was really nice. It gave me a warm and fuzzy feeling about the company.
You like the
awesome
card stock. The font was
the
cool.
The card stock was it was
this
yeah,
all
heavy. Benefit.
This all made you write a good
heavy
review.
Paper. Yeah, it had a nice teal color on it. Made me feel happy.
I mean, the reason I kind of make it a flippant comment in the middle of your discussion of the story is that humans aren't as simple as we think we are, right? We are swayed by things like that, absolutely.
Yeah. Yes.
And that is why it makes sense to at least explicitly say, I'm being swayed. I mean, don't you, when it says...
Well, that's they have to disclose that they got it for a discount or got it for free.
In my mind, I don't think there's anything wrong with it as long as you're being clear. This review is being managed by somebody that was paid assessment
well,
for it.
If,
in my mind, that clears it. Like, it's okay to do that. So why is Amazon stopping?
Well, different sellers have gone online and bought people to review, like put up reviews
sure.
that were obvious shills. And Amazon has been very forceful, going so far as to sue these companies for fraudulent activities. The ones where they're, you know, Ben and his fingernail clippers
yeah.
are rating those products 0.38 stars higher.
That's significant.
Now, yeah.
Given that they're only 5 stars.
Right. And
0.38 is significant?
Yeah,
it
that's
is
7%.
Because
you
if
sound
you
like
are
work.
Below four and if you're below 4.5 stars, you show up as a 4-star rating on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
If you go up 0.38 stars, you are suddenly now at 4.74 star. You know, you're up above that threshold and you now show up as a 5-star product, which automatically, you know, gives you that extra bump.
Yeah.
And or it could be from 3 to 4 stars because the filter on Amazon is, you know, 4 stars and up. That is automatically going to filter out a whole bunch of products that are there.
Yeah.
And 4.36 stars, this is something that was Amazon was releasing as a statistic. If you're at 4.36 stars as an average, you're at the 54th percentile.
Whoa.
If you because people in general, like if they go to buy something, it's chances are it's the thing they want unless something goes wrong.
Right.
Wait, so you're saying that about half of products are 4.38 stars or higher?
Yeah. 4.36 stars.
3.46 stars. If you get any small amount of benefit, it's not like, oh, okay, 0.3, you know, your product is now 0.3 stars higher out of 5. It's really 0.3 stars higher out of a much smaller range because most of the products are really high and there's not much.
Well, it depends because there's also a self-selection there in a lot of cases where people will say like which one is which, how which one do I like better. But yes, in general, if it fits what you need it to do, people are going to rate it highly. And shouldn't they?
Have any of you ever used the wirecutter.com? They depend a lot on Amazon reviews and expert sort of opinions on various parts of gear, computers and phones and like. They have a whole thing where they talk about Amazon reviews and how really unuseful they are because of exactly what you're saying.
Yeah. And then at this isn't like the bell curve where all reviewers, you know, must give a certain number of 1-star ratings and all reviewers must give only a small percentage of 5-star ratings and you have to give a huge number of 3-star ratings. That's not how the human brain works.
I've always wondered whether Amazon takes that into account. If you have a reviewer is reviewing and mostly giving 5 stars and then they give a 3-star, that 3-star is a more negative than, you know, if you give 20 reviews of 5 stars mm-hmm. and you give 2 reviews of 3 stars and 1 review of a 1-star, because you normally rate so high, your low rating is worth more.
Heavier,
you can also say that your continual high rating is worth less.
In addition
so
to
if
that,
if they did it that way, that's the kind of thing that we do at Netflix,
well,
right?
They do, or at least I assume they do because I know of other vendors that do or sales areas. But even beyond that, what many online retailers will do is depending upon the type of item, it's going to skew the average rating more or less.
Right.
This also happens with like Yelp reviews or Google reviews for a restaurant, that type of thing. And so if you bump up 0.38 stars from that 54th percentile,
yeah,
it goes to 4.74 stars. Uh-huh. As a new average, and you are now in the 94th percentile.
Oh. So, yeah. That's so a big there's shift. Not as much difference, or there's not as much distance to travel, so that 0.3 jumps you much further.
Mm-hmm. So, if you were 16. Trying to work out a percentile for, if you were to adjust Amazon to that level to say, like, okay, 4.36 stars is now your 50% mark, and generate a new bell curve based upon that.
Yeah, yeah, it's a big shift.
That gets very skewed by this. So.
That's probably why my nail clipper company that I bought from was so eager to give me a second pair. I wonder what their margins are. They're probably pretty good, but they're definitely not making as much money off of me if they're giving me two instead of one.
I am sure that a good review of you from you is going to be worth more than one clipper.
Yeah.
Dee Dee's posted. Thank you for posting that. Let's talk about Amazon reviews from the Wirecutter, which I put in the show notes. And let's move on, Dee Dee, to your first story about the iPhone, actually.
So it seems like the news is all about people getting hacked left and right lately. And unfortunately, this story is not going to make you feel any better about that. It's just here to explain that there's sort of a marketplace for these things. And it's just heated up a little bit. So Zerodium is a sort of a broker of exploits. And they have put up... they've increased their security exploit bounty for iPhones and iPads from 1.5 million, which is a really big number, from their previous 1 million. So,
wow. So that means that if I wanted to buy an iPhone exploit so I could take advantage of people's iPhones or something if I was malicious, that would be about the amount that I would pay, and I would probably expect to get at least that much from the exploiting or the hacking that I do.
You'd probably want to make 4 to 8 times the amount that you would pay for a bounty before you sort of gave it up or let the provider, in this case Apple, fix it if you ever did. They also traffic in bounties for Google and their Android operating system. So a little bit lower. They've just bumped it from 50 grand to 80. So you can see that there's sort of an outsized target on Apple's back for this.
Now, these are bounties for the exploit themselves, right? This means they don't necessarily have an exploit, but they'd be willing to pay this much if an exploit was available. Is that right?
Right, right. So what they're looking for are things that you could sort of you could execute surreptitiously without the user knowing that anything has happened or gone wrong.
Right.
So there's all sorts of vulnerabilities that you could be exposed to in any system that you're using, your phone, your computer, etc. And Apple and Google, they themselves also have bug bounties, but they're a little bit lower stakes and easier to submit bugs and lower level vulnerabilities to. I think Apple tops out about 250,000, which while a lot of money, does not really hold a candle to 1.5 million. Mm. But the things that we're looking at the 1.5 million marker are really big things. So really big 0 days that we've seen a couple in the last couple of years, and the people purchasing them, well, you hope, aren't governments, shady actors and whatnot. Like there was a story about the United Arab Emirates sort of getting into the market and using it to target dissidents, and it just gets really nasty. That actors like Zerodium are out there sort of creating this vibrant shadow market for what's like all the users' phones and privacy, and at a large scale, it's all at stake.
And to unpack some jargon, Dee Dee, what's a 0 day?
A 0 day is a vulnerability that is unknown to the vendor or to any of the people operating on the vendor's platform. So if you had something that would, say, crash an iPhone based on SMS messages or something, which happened in the last year and a half or so, and Apple was not aware of that, and the day-to-day users were not aware of that, and you were able to exploit that, that would be a zero day because nobody else knew about that.
And I don't know if we covered the story, but the last Black Hat, Apple actually announced that they would actually be giving people, giving bounties to for bugs, 25,000 up to 50,000, depending, and up, even up to 200,000. On some of their services, and that was a first for Apple to be able to do that. Now, you have to be invited in as a researcher. You can't just discover it and then submit, but Apple has moved to that stage where they're willing to play in that marketplace, which makes sense, though I have to say if you could get $1.5 million or you could get $200,000 from Apple, yeah. You've got to be a pretty ethical person to choose the $200,000.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say. If you're a security researcher and you're, you know, you want to avoid doing potentially very malicious and bad things, then, you know, you would choose $200,000 or something. But there are a lot of people out there who are in it for very different reasons.
That's right. So as we bring up stories and all the things we talk about, we add to our show notes, which, of course, are at the GeekSpeak webpage for today's show, which is the episode 41 of season 16. It's also the show for October 5th, 2016. And the other thing that we do now, and I just started doing, is adding chapter marks and notes into the podcast description. So in your podcast player of choice, if it's a good one, you should be able to see all the stuff we're talking about, and you can click to it from there and read the directly the stories, including the one I just mentioned from Apple Black Hat.
Not just all the things we're talking about, but you can actually see them listed out. And
that's
with
right.
Time codes and all that stuff. So you can say like, oh, I don't like the story, and just skip to the next one rather than skipping 30 seconds ahead, 30 seconds ahead. Oh, no, I skipped. I passed it. Okay, go back 10
that's
seconds.
Right. Full navigation. Of course, yeah. That's only the players that actually can support that. On iOS, I recommend Overcast, which is actually, I think, currently free. It's pretty awesome to use. And also the little things we mention, you can directly link to that to read them.
Yeah.
And so
Do you know of one on Android, or should I pull out my phone right now and test? I use Beyond Pod, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, use Beyond Pod and pull up the GeekSpeak feed and try the last episode.
I'm going to do that right now.
While Ben does that and tests out his favorite player on an Android device, let's talk about voting systems, shall we, Miles? It seems to be that time of year.
Yeah. and it's not looking good.
Oh, boy.
Pennsylvania was already a battleground state. Already up for play, and has a lot of electoral votes to bring to the table. Trump made a comment a while back saying, "If I lose Pennsylvania, it means something. You know, someone stole the election." Made some comment about that, like that the only way he could possibly lose it was this. Well, I don't know that I agree with his interpretation of it. Mm. At the same time, Pennsylvania's got some real problems with regard to cybersecurity and their election systems.
Okay, let me just back up one quick second. On the last debate, on the presidential debate, he was asked about whether he would support Hillary if she won the election, and he did a ramble and closed with, "But I would support her if she won the election." So he has backtracked on that. It sounds like he is going to support the electoral system.
Well,
but go on, Pennsylvania.
Yes. The issue there is that you have a lot of these old systems that are not single-purpose machines. They are not single-purpose CPUs and operating systems. They are a full computer that does not have a paper trail, for the most part, and is running operating systems like Windows XP, which Microsoft has not patched for security updates since 2014.
Please tell me they don't have Wi-Fi cards on them and open USB ports. I mean, the one thing about actually being able to attack the system is you do have to have access physical to the machine, right? These things are normally locked to some degree.
Well, that's the thing, though, is do they have to be locked at the time of the election? Or what happens if you get access to the machine a week or two before the election?
Or
and
6
are able
years
to
before the election.
Yes.
I mean, anytime,
yeah,
really.
True.
And are able to adapt the processes. What happens if you can alter the data cards that are going into the first place?
I think it would be far easier to attack the machines that they tabulate these on, and that would also include other machines outside of the Pennsylvania machines with no paper trail. That would be the other ones that seem more secure, not
a lot of
on
times these aren't networked. A lot of times these are the tabulation machines themselves. Like you are going to the machine and you're getting the tally from the machine itself and then getting those.
What interface does it have to read the tally? Is it like a flashcard you pull out or is it like print on show on screen, this is what happened here?
That I don't know off the top of my head. But as far as what is the weak link in our election systems, unfortunately, Pennsylvania has that honor or that dishonor.
that honor.
Why them specifically?
Just because they have machines that don't have a paper audit. They are purely electronic in terms of their result set. And they're known to be running on an insecure operating system as a base. Like it's built on a foundation of sand.
I got to say that I used to be very bullish on electronic voting systems, mostly because I liked the idea of the Kim Stanley Robinson's series Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars, in which at one point in the colonization of Mars, everyone has personal computers and they can vote and change over the political system in a matter of minutes because the populace speaks. And that was, I think, a relatively immature perspective on how you might be able to change the world, because now I'm worried about an electorate that is quickly moving and not thoughtful. And I think an ability to push a button and change the president would be kind of devious for our political system, especially since people might just do that because of it's Sunday. You know, who knows? At the same time, I'm still kind of bullish on the idea of electronic voting until I really started investigating it. And in my mind, there's nothing better than just Scantron paper, pieces of paper. You can do it relatively quickly. You have an original copy. It's really hard to mass produce the original copies. You know, like there's all these side effects that just physical things are easier to keep track of than digital things, because digital things aren't things.
Well, that's one thing with regard to voting in Santa Cruz, the only place I've ever done electronic voting, is I use the electronic voting machine because I figured, hey, if anyone's going to be doing it, why not a geek? At least I can see what issues are there and comment on them. When I was doing it, I used the touchscreen, pressed my choices. My choice came up on the screen. I said, yes, this is what I want. And then it used a printer and it printed out a summary of everything that I did that I could see through a piece of clear plastic. So I could not actually touch the paper. But I could see it scroll by and see it was actually printed.
It was representational of what you just did.
Yes. And then when I was done, it cut it. And so it wasn't also a sequential
item
that came through.
And then mixed it in the bin so that they could go back and read that thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I was much more comfortable with that.
That works too. The one thing I'd have to say about that, though, is that you're relying in that situation on the human being noticing that there's a difference between the paper and what they've done. And I guess maybe that's beneficial in the sense
But that's actually – it was part of the workflow on there. After you voted, the screen told you now it's in that little window.
Look at that.
Look at that then click here to verify.
Nice.
Like that actually was in there. So I can't give any fault to electronic voting machines in that regard.
Right.
I really can't. It's just some machines are done very poorly and there really isn't any excuse for it. The amount of money we spend on elections – right now that we can't spare any for making sure that our elections are fair and secure is unconscionable.
I am still looking forward to voting in my home next to the internet to do my research on a paper ballot that I will mail in.
Have you already gotten your paper ballot?
I think it's in the mail.
Okay, cool. Ben, let's talk about some space news.
Yeah, I've spent
purge ourselves of this political flouvla.
I've spent the last 2 minutes trying to spell out the name of the comet that we visited, so that way I could read it on air. So we'll see how this goes. I'll probably get it wrong. 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko is a comet. It looks kind of like a rubber ducky in the way that space objects kind of resemble things, but actually don't really at all.
But is it the one?
The one?
Rubber ducky.
You just described a phenomenon known as...
Oh, what's the word for that?
Pareidolia.
Yeah, pareidolia, that's right. Where you see a thing and you say, huh, that kind of looks like a face or like a rabbit or you never say, oh, that looks like a cloud.
The human brain is oriented toward pattern recognition, and it will recognize patterns even where there are none.
Okay, so what did the rubber ducky comet do?
The reason that I bring up the rubber ducky and that it's so important is that this comet looks kind of like two things that kind of smushed together.
I see, like the head and the body of a rubber ducky.
Yeah, and then the neck is a little bit skinnier. So, we launched a space probe called Rosetta. That's the mission, and we launched it back in 2004. And we sent it off to rendezvous with Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko. I'm getting better at this. And it rendezvoused in 2014. And this was the first mission in history where a probe that we built orbited a comet and kind of escorted it along its journey as it orbits the sun. So we took a whole bunch of pictures and everything. We also, a couple months after we got to the comet, launched a little lander, which landed on the comet and took some pictures. I believe those were the first pictures that we took from the surface of a comet, which is pretty cool. And that mission just came to its close. So we got to the point where we had done a lot of really good science, and we decided, okay, we've done this enough. It's done a lot of good work, and we did a soft landing on the comet. So the thing that was orbiting the comet, not the lander, but the actual probe that was orbiting the comet, we fired some rockets to slow it down, and it just like slowly landed on the comet, and that's where it will rest next to its lander, or some probably.
So it wasn't designed to land on the planet.
No,
they
it
just
wasn't.
Did
no.
it? What? But
well, okay. that's how they ended the mission.
It seems like that's a common thing in space exploration. When you're done, make the thing hit the body. Like it's like didn't
well,
we?
Well, okay,
we
there are reasons
sometimes?
For this, right? They could take. They could take certain kinds of pictures as they got closer and closer and closer to it that they didn't have the resolution to take when they were further out. So that's a good reason, right? But also you don't want to leave things floating about in free space in general.
No big deal, but an orbit around that comet was, from what I remember, quite unstable.
Hmm.
It's a very small body. Gravity is very weak, and it's a very irregularly shaped body.
Right. We're generally very bad at not cleaning up after ourselves in space. If you look at Earth's orbit, you'll see that there are tons of things zipping around, and it's kind of like it's described often as a shooting gallery for. Like astronauts on the mm-hmm. International Space Station, for example, and if something comes whizzing by and like punctures a hole in the wall, well,
not so
there's
good.
Not really much you can do.
At this location, though, it either orbiting poorly or landing on it is not going to affect anybody because space
true.
Is really big.
Unless you have XKCD and Randall Monroe commenting on it, in which he was intimating. One person said, "So did we alter its orbit so it doesn't hit the Earth?" That wasn't really the point of the. Oh, just give it to him. Yes, the comet will not hit the Earth. Yes, we did it.
All right, thanks for the space news.
Yeah, linked up on geekspeak.org is a fantastic article by my favorite person almost in the world, Phil Plait, also known as the Bad Astronomer. He runs a fantastic blog, and he wrote a nice long article about this and all of the science that we were able to do because we soft landed the probe on the what's it called thing? Comet.
The
Thank
comet.
You.
Yes. Cool. Thank you very much.
Oh, they also made this cute little animation to celebrate the end of the mission too. So you can see that if you go to the website.
Awesome. Didi, give us some Internet of Things information, would you?
So almost as plentiful as the new Internet of Things are the amount of Internet of Things that are now totally pwned. Pwned as in owned in a hacked type of manner.
Mm.
Meaning someone 20 years ago mistyped and now we have a new
you got
portmanteau.
Oh, no, I typed pwned. Oh, no. And then it took off.
I don't know if that was a mistype or just a brilliant slip, but here we have pwn, and it works. So you have not just been owned, you have been pwned. And in this case, the malware dubbed Mirai spread to a record number of Internet of use because it's using the Internet of Things as sort of a basis for hosting its pwnage. The surface area is huge, so we have seen historically large DDoS attacks coming from this botnet. And I don't know if this is altruism on the part of the hacker or the people involved, or if they're done with the exploits as it is, or if they just want to teach the world their brilliance. But they've dropped the source code for the malware, and anybody could go learn and pick up the techniques for grabbing a whole lot of IoT devices, which from internet-connected refrigerators to Wi-Fi cameras to people who have those mood lights that are connected by their phone.
Uh-oh. I have those mood lights that are connected by my phone.
You used to have mood lights, and now you have a botnet.
Wait, I have a constant dance
party. Do they still work after you drilled into your iPhone 7?
Right.
Cool. I mean, it's kind of sad to see this, but it's also really neat that they released the source code, because this kind of – I mean, first off, we've known for a while that the Internet of Things market has been less than adequate with regards to security. And this kind of large exploit and taking advantage of that poor practice of security on Internet of Things is exactly the kind of high-profile systemic system that has to take place in order for us to actually do something about it. So at some level, it's a good thing that we're moving in this direction where it's high-profile.
I hope that we don't wind up with a regular feature like we used to have the odd USB of the week. That I hope it's not like the segment about the most random Internet of Things pwnage this month or something.
Yeah.
But
how bad is this process? Is it something we can take a look at and see?
Well, it might get better or worse once we run out of IP space, actually. IPv4 is notoriously staying past its expiration date, and IPv6 might help or hinder this. There's a lot of possibilities, but allowing devices to talk to each other on the open internet without sort of regard to limiting or whitelisting or any number of security practices is definitely creating an interesting future for us all.
If you'd like to see a live map of like how bad this infection is, you can actually take a look from the GeekSpeak website. It's a live map of the Miria malware infection in the world, and it's basically showing the most recent infections in real time. It's nice and horrible to see.
That's horrible. Yeah.
It's a lot of blinking lights.
I actually have not seen that, but I will be going to geekspeak.org after I cover this next story, which is, it segues nicely. Speaking of security, our favorite topic today, let's talk about Yahoo. Fantastic at not being secure. So 6 years ago, there was a really big hack, Chinese military hackers, and they penetrated Yahoo's computer systems and Google and a whole bunch of other companies. And it was interesting to see the way companies like Google reacted. They really, really staffed up on security experts and paid them a lot of money.
What time frame was this?
This was 6 years ago.
Okay. I remember the kind of surge at that point.
Yeah, yeah. And security researchers were like, woohoo!
Money!
Awesome. Money and jobs! Yahoo did not do that. And in fact, Yahoo also was hit by a breach 2 years ago. I don't know if you guys remember that. I don't.
I feel like I
because
do.
No, you don't. Because they just recently announced it. Two years later.
What was... Oh, right. I just recently heard this. This is a big... like
this was
all their data kind of
half
thing.
A billion people. Yeah. So...
and it happened 2 years ago.
It happened 2 years ago.
So quick, change your password 2 years ago.
Right. Yeah.
That and it's auspicious timing because they're in talks to be purchased by Verizon.
Uh-huh.
And so now there's this seems to be this huge liability that now comes along with the package.
Why did they announce it now? Are you going to buy us? By the way, we did something really bad.
Well, I wonder
I think they got shamed into it. Someone had come out with it. It got
right. Like you have to air this dirty laundry because it's really bad. Yeah. So there's a whole article about this on the New York Times. One thing that I found really interesting was the internal name for Yahoo's security team at Yahoo reportedly was the Paranoids, which seems like a really horrible name for a really important team, right? It just kind of indicates how undervalued they were, right? Because, I mean, if you think about it, as a front-end web developer, I do my work, and then everybody at the company sees it in the form of, oh, I went to the website, and I see stuff, right? That's me. But if you're a security researcher and you do your job right, nothing happens, right?
Right.
So no one sees your work unless they're also a security researcher or they're watching you. So that's not great. And if furthermore you are called something derogatory like the Paranoids, first of all, that doesn't really inspire trust. That doesn't make you feel like you're being respected. It doesn't engender trust among your fellow coworkers.
It sounds slightly derogatory.
Yeah, and also as a security researcher, you could just go work at Google. Like, why are you going to stick around, right?
Golden handcuffs, man.
Yeah.
Well, for Yahoo, I'm not sure. I just decided to log into my Yahoo email account to see if I ever had an announcement about this problem. I have not had an announcement for this problem.
Oh, no.
But more than that, I have like two messages this year. No, four messages this year.
Oh, really?
And then the messages prior to that were 2013, which is amazing.
Wow.
I'm assuming that I've erased them over time or something.
Did you check your spam?
I don't want to do that.
That's like, don't look at the comments.
My spam folder's empty, besides an ad for NFL. Oh, they know me so well.
I feel necessary to pipe in for all those people who love Yahoo Fantasy out there. You know who you are. I got the notice. I changed my password many times since 2014.
Well, that's good. But not.
You should not use your password for Yahoo, for Google, for anything that you find important anywhere else.
Yeah.
That's the message.
Yeah, definitely.
One time. Hey, Didi, when you say Yahoo Fantasy, are you talking about Yahoo Fantasy Sports?
Yes.
So you like play that? You have like a virtual teams, and you compete those teams with other people.
Yeah, going to like the fifth or sixth year of hockey. Right.
How are you doing?
I've won two out of the four or five years that we've done it.
How do you?
Actually, I won both leagues last year.
How do your players feel knowing that you're moving them to different teams against their will?
I think that maybe they have a small. Bite-sized, since it's virtual, moment of existential crisis, yeah. And then they get over it.
Did you say bite-sized as in B-I-T-E or B-Y-T-E?
Yeah.
The world may never know.
So yeah, takeaways. One, generally, don't use Yahoo, I would say. Because if there are stories with a number of unnamed sources saying, yeah, it's really bad there, in terms of security, maybe that's not where you want to, you know, have your email, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one. And also, if someone gets access to your email, that's really bad because password resets for other services will usually go to your email address. And if a nefarious actor has access to your email, then they could very easily escalate their privileges to get access to your Netflix account or your bank account potentially, or maybe not
so
bank.
Good.
But so that's one. Number two, if you do have a Yahoo account and you want to continue having a Yahoo account, make sure you're not using that password anywhere else. That's super, super important. And also, generally, I would say if you have like account recovery settings in other important services, make sure that they don't point to your Yahoo email. I would point them to somewhere else. And yeah, this also segues into a story that I have about risky password practices.
Please do. You know, I'm actually trying to change my password as we speak because I
haven't
done
it
in a while.
Yeah, you looked really like intense there.
I can't seem to find it. I'm sure I'll find it eventually, but go on.
You could probably click I forgot my password and lie to them, and then they'll have to change it.
I'll go use Google
to
search for it.
Oh, but part of the hack is they turned off your security questions because they're insecure.
Uh-huh.
So this is also an interesting story that came out just a couple days ago. from helpnetsecurity.com. I didn't know that website existed. But they have a study by Lab42 that polled consumers across the U.S., Germany, France, New Zealand, Australia, and the U.K. And this study is, or this article is kind of about the psychology around why so many of us use bad passwords. And unfortunately, the problem is not super simple. It's not just that people don't know that they shouldn't reuse passwords. In fact, most people, I think it was 91% of respondents to this said, yeah, there is an inherent risk associated with reusing passwords. And yet, 61% of those people continue to use the same or similar passwords anyway. And more than half, it says 55%, do so while fully understanding the risk. So in other words, yeah, I know what I'm doing is really bad, and I'm not going to change it because
I don't care.
I don't care enough. Yeah. It's not.
I understand that human condition, I have to say. I mean, the only reason I'm actually able to manage passwords well is I've bought into having a password manager.
Right.
And that helps me. Without that assistant application, I wouldn't do it. It's too much.
Yeah.
By the way, I cannot change my password on my Yahoo account.
You can, why?
Because at one point, my Yahoo account and my AT&T service were the same thing. How that happened. I must have DSL with AT&T. So now I'm in a Yahoo AT&T odd world that when I try to change the password, makes me log in to AT&T. I don't have an AT&T account connected to Yahoo, so I can't do that. So I'm just kind of in an endless loop.
Oh, that's not good. Well,
if you leave your account alone long enough, they will just purge it.
I need it, though. I use it for things.
You do?
I don't know.
At least you hadn't received a message in a couple
still
years.
I think at one point when Yahoo bought Flickr, they merged those things. So my Flickr account is connected to it. And I think the same password.
Not Flickr.
That might be your way in.
I wonder if you can reset your password.
Yeah.
Like, well, I forgot my password.
This and other things we'll learn in future episodes.
Right. But in any case, this psychological thing, I guess basically saying like, yeah, I understand the risk. I'm not going to do anything about it. Actually kind of connects to what I was saying before about security researchers. You know, like how are security researchers seen? Oh, yeah, I know what they do is probably important, but I've actually never seen them do anything. So I'm not going to value them as much. You know, it's a similar psychology of like when you don't see something, you don't value it as much. Whereas if you see it all the time, you're going to value it quite a bit more.
Reminds me of a fun little anecdote, if you don't mind.
Go for it.
During World War II, there were some planes that were coming in and they were getting shot up. You know, it was the height of World War II. And these bombers were coming back with huge holes, like parts of wing missing and tail gone and stuff like that. And so they were worried about all these losses, and so hey, let's reinforce these bombers with some extra armor. But you can't put armor over the entire thing; the bombers wouldn't be able to get off the ground. You need to be very specific as to where you put that armor. And so they're putting armor in all these places where there were holes showing up. Till one person said, "Wait, stop! Do not do this." Mathematician, by the way. The places where the holes were the places where the plane could survive being hit. You have to put armor in the places where there were never any holes.
Oh, interesting.
That's really
because
good.
Those are the planes that never made it back. That's kind of what security is like. You don't see it. It's that thing that you don't see where
I love that being the solution.
That is the stereotypical case or the seminal case for confirmation bias.
Yes. Yes. It's like I always get disappointed when we you have a big meeting with lots of people and everybody gets together and everybody's there. And at the end of the meeting, you say, well, we are all going to make it. Too bad not everybody could make it. When should the next meeting happen? And you don't ask then because the people that couldn't make it can't respond, which means you'll have another meeting where those people can't make it. You'll keep on not getting those people. So it's,
you know,
crucial.
It's funny. My team's Monday sync, I'd never gone to that meeting.
At the Facebook?
For this exact reason.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And it really
something else that was recurring.
And for those who feel very comfortable in their jobs and really want to take a stand, that's when you go to a meeting, you realize that, this could have just been an email. You go back to your desk after the meeting, and then you type up what the meeting was about, and you say, see, this meeting could have been an email.
Is this why you don't work at Google anymore?
No, actually, this isn't.
Well, so
actually, at Google, they had a policy that if you were in a meeting and you realized like there was no point to me being here, you could leave.
Oh yeah, well that's it's like that.
Miles,
yeah,
there was no. It sounds like you're a developer. Developers are notoriously annoyed by meetings because you need these big long chunks for brain to work, right?
Well, it's interesting in corporate culture how meetings work. I guess we're segging here. In the morning is when a lot of managers like to schedule their meetings. And so they'll schedule them so all the managers get together and all the project managers and program managers. And they'll get their day started with all the things that need to get done. So then they get their marching orders. And then in the afternoon, you end up with all the programmers and the grunts, as it
were. Code reviews, things like that meetings?
No. Just all the things – the strategy meetings, like where things are going to go. So you have the upper management getting together in the morning, and then everyone else gets the message sent to them via the product managers, program managers in the afternoon. The programmers I know are not very much in the way of morning people. Mm-hmm. And so they're not in the office yet when a lot of these other meetings are happening, and then they get to the office and suddenly they barrage with a whole bunch of meetings right in the middle of their day,
right?
Mm-hmm. Which completely breaks the flow of anything they're trying to work on. And then you have the choice of you either work late or you just don't get the thing done on time.
Case
and then,
point.
And then you
developer.
Wonder like, yeah, well, then you get into this whole thing of like, oh, now the timelines are slipping. I wonder why that's happening.
Right. Right. No, it's hard. You gotta relentlessly protect your time. It's difficult.
So it's a curious thing. I'd be curious to know if anyone has a company that they know where a fairly sizable one where this becomes
an
issue.
We're talking like 200 people or more?
100 or more actually might do it. Yeah. That's where the culture a lot of times will change.
I found 150.
Sure.
Yeah.
But something that you think is beyond small business where you know everyone that works there.
Right.
Where you suddenly have divisions where you don't know the people that work there. And have it so that the upper management or the people who are in charge when they're dealing with the people in the middle, like the middle managers to send you the marching orders, if they could have their meetings at a different time.
I think you're trying to solve a problem that's not something you can just solve by timing and scheduling.
Maybe that's true.
But let's move on. Miles?
I've just got one thing to leave us with. Speaking of passwords, only 29% of customers change their passwords for security reasons. The number one reason people change their passwords is because they forgot it.
Yeah, I believe that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's not super surprising, but yeah. Like... Ugh,
or
gosh.
The system said, you must change your password. And the person goes, I don't
want to do that.
And then 2 days later, they go, I forgot what my password was that I just changed it to.
So, Miles, tell me about this judge in Texas.
A judge in Texas has stated that, well, the U.S. is going to give up control of the internet.
This is what the judge said?
Yeah.
Why was a judge in Texas responding to that?
Now that I have your attention.
Well, for the same reason that I don't remember what state decided that Pluto was a planet again?
No. This one's legit.
Oh, this one's legit.
Yeah.
Wait, the U.S.
Pluto's
the...
not a planet?
It's a dwarf planet.
Oh, yes.
It's a Plutoid. I don't know. Yeah.
It'll always be a planet to me.
Well, it is a planet. It's a dwarf planet. Anyway.
No, planet with a capital P, planet.
It's a planet.
So anyway.
We threw you off.
The U.S. invented the internet. There's no question about this. Came from DARPA, the ARPANET, and then came to be what we know as the internet. And one of the major foundations of the internet is DNS, domain name server, or domain name service. And that is how you're able to type in www.bbc.com, which is coincidentally where the story I'm reading it from comes from. Resolves into an IP address, and then you can actually get the information. It has migrated over time from one person to a nonprofit to an organization known as ICANN.
And you're talking about DNS, the thing that tells everybody what all the websites resolve, what addresses they resolve into.
Yes.
So that's service.
Yes. So you have ICANN. ICANN being the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, and it was currently under U.S. government oversight. And so, in general, the U.S. never really stepped in. They never really had a reason to. This was Department of Commerce is where ICANN is under the umbrella of. So they could say that that ICANN or IANA as well would not be allowed to do a certain thing, that would not be able to resolve a particular set of domains, or would not be allowed to, do X, Y, or Z as a policy decision. They haven't. They've been very hands-off with it. But still, people have been clamoring, the international community has been clamoring for, we don't want this thing to be under the auspices of a U.S. government agency.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I thought we moved away from it being a nonprofit in the United States to a more federal – I mean a non-federal thing, yeah?
A non-national thing, you mean.
Yeah. Sorry.
The decision had been made, but it had been fought by four attorneys general in the U.S. saying like, no, we can't turn this over to countries like China and Russia. You know, a fair amount of jingoism involved. And the judge came back to say, wait, hold on. You know, we're talking about – which organization is controlling the root servers, and that's going to be one that is under the auspices of the UN. And in general, they're very hands-off. And the argument that the US was giving for they have to keep control of it was that you can't really trust those other countries to look after the internet. You can only trust the US.
That's not a very good national
argument. Yeah, a lot of countries didn't like being told that they were not trustworthy enough to be able to hold on to be able to manage their own top level domain services. And top level domain services are things like .uk for Great Britain or .cn for China.
And of course the US actually owns roots that are not really associated with the country because we actually invented it. So we have .com, .org, .net.
In addition to .us.
Which are, in addition to .us. But .us was added later as other countries were added.
But we also have things like .mil and .gov, which are top-level domains, but they are military and government respectively. Now, the argument had come up from some senators that were not necessarily technically savvy. They're saying, we can't have those – because of – then it's under UN auspices, then some other country could try to gum up the works and end up cutting us off, cutting the military off from their own domain. If the military is relying on these servers to resolve where it goes to .mil, which they are not, there is a much bigger problem than the oversight of
one of the
from
major,
the UN.
One of the major flaws in how the internet works is the DNS, domain name service, is actually not robust or secure. And so it's just something you can't rely upon. So if you're dealing with high-level security, you don't do it at that level. You do it IP addresses. Even IP address tables can be munched with. Mm-hmm. So you have to be extremely careful when you're dealing with definite access, always-on access. We talk about it being robust and great, but it's also extremely fragile.
And that's also why things like DNSSEC came about, to be able to do
security.
To do a signature on these domains so that they can't be altered at will. So now DNS will be looked over by the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, which is now part of the UN. And so since that last hurdle has been reached, even though many of the servers will still be managed out of Los Angeles, or rather the management of those servers will be out of Los Angeles, the root level servers are actually geographically located all across the globe. Not much is really going to change. The sky isn't falling. But just so you know, the internet domain naming system is no longer controlled solely by the U.S.
And on that, GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0 and use our stuff any way you'd like it. Just let them know the geek said hello. I want to thank our patrons. Also, I want to thank Chandler, our intern, and Greg Merkley, who provided this week's working title, Jack Reviews Mirias. Mirias? Mirias? The botnet thing? Is it called Mirias? Mirias? Jack Reviews Mirias Password. Also, Michael Newman of Pet Star Music, who provided our theme song, and thank you for being here for episode 41 of season 16. Didi, Miles, Ben, I want to offer this opportunity now that we're in post-show to bring up anything else you wanted to talk about.
I think I have a few stories left.
You do have more stories left.
Like,
why don't you go ahead and
do
one?
But before you go on to the next story, it's like, why Texas?
Yeah, why Texas?
Because that is where the challenge was filed.
Oh, okay, interesting. So so it didn't have to go to a U.S. or a governmental court.
It could just, well, you have to choose some venue.
Right, it could be settled on a state court level.
Right.
Just one of the federal district courts?
Hold on, let's
happen
see
to be
here.
Texas?
Actually, I don't know where...
It's probably just where the court is held. I mean, the federal courts
are
actually...
That's what I'm trying to see whether
states.
Or not it was... Yeah, I would imagine it's a federal court, but I don't know if it was a district court or if it was a...
Well, if it's Texas, it would be the fifth.
Well, it's just a judge
court,
in
right?
Texas, but I don't know if the actual venue, like if the judge was a federal judge in Texas or if it was a Texas judge, that type of thing.
Is it the ninth district? No, that's California.
Well, wow,
it sounds
we
like post show, doesn't it?
Yeah,
it does. Lovely. You're welcome to say goodbye
know.
To us.
I don't know. I'd have to
week.
Look it up. I don't see it in the BBC article here.
You know, it'd be really cool is if we could get really good data, good listenership data, not just who started to listen, but
who finished,
and when they dropped off. It'd be really interesting to see like what the distribution is at the end.
At the end of a couple of weeks ago, we talked about VI and Emacs for like 6 hours at the end of the show.
6 hours,
somewhere
like
during
40
that,
minutes. Yeah,
somewhere
I'm
during
glad
that,
I don't listen to the show.
Somewhere during that time, I said, "Hey, if you use Emacs or Vim, let us
oh,
know."
That's where all those emails came from.
Yep.
So everyone wrote to us.
People
about...
listen. At least people that listen use text editors listen to the end of the show. You know what you guys?
People who care about text editors. Listen to our are the type of people that listen to our show, and they are vocal,
right? Basically, yeah. This
guys,
is a topic.
I feel like I need to state for the record that I use Vim and Dvorak.
Dvorak keyboard. You've been using Dvorak since 2006. Maybe that's what we said.
You're like a geek squared.
Yeah,
that is amazing. How is it when you like are at your parents and you want to help them with something? Do your hands just freak out on a keyboard that's a QWERTY,
or is it like another language?
Well, I mean, like, I still use a phone, and that's a QWERTY keyboard.
Wait, Didi, I have a question. do you speak two languages?
I speak English. I took a little bit of French and Pig Latin.
Oh, Pig.
Can you
no,
type
I was
on
just,
a QWERTY? Oh, go ahead.
No, I was just wondering, like, because I see with people who are bilingual, who are fairly fluent, that, like, when you speak to them in the opposite language than the one that they're currently speaking in, like they kind of do this weird, like I'm flipping a switch in my brain
yep.
thing.
Yep.
And then they can just go down that track, that other track. And it's totally fine. And I'm curious if QWERTY and Dvorak, if it's like that, where you
I
just
would say,
flip a switch.
I've heard
it
referred to as the
it.
Second voice. Yeah.
I would say yes. My colleague here at Netflix, Michael, who I probably have on the show at some point, does use Dvorak, and he used to use QWERTY. And sometimes when he's writing, all of a sudden he looks down the screen and it's gibberish because his brain just switched back to QWERTY and he wasn't aware of it. So it's definitely a toggle state, which would make sense. He's about to switch back to QWERTY again after doing Dvorak for 2 years. So I'm curious what's going to happen to him.
I'm curious. We should talk about that with him on the show.
Didi, have you ever tried to switch back to QWERTY?
Like I said, I have to use a QWERTY on the phone all the time.
But like a physical full-size one where you could touch type, you know?
And when I'm on other people's machines, I'm using their QWERTY keyboards, but not in my regular day-to-day.
But are you touch typing on other people's keyboards?
Very slowly.
And I have to say that using a phone keypad is not QWERTY, because QWERTY represents the home row line, and it's not that. Sets of three, and there's three across. I mean, it's not QWERTY.
Too tiny.
But I still respect what you're saying. So, speaking of post-show, I've got to say something.
I'm just saying, I could type really quickly with my thumbs in QWERTY. It's
okay.
All.
There is one keyboard we have not mentioned yet. It's the ABCDEFGHHAKLMNOP keyboard, which...
What order is that?
It goes A, B, C.
Stop.
I learned to program...
You're going to talk about Colmac.
Keyboard.
No, there's a Sesame Street song about this. Actually, I have to find it and we'll put it on the show page. But
it's the element of P keyboard.
I think it's K. It starts with K.
I learned to program on an ABC whatever keyboard. on my TI-83 Plus graphing calculator in Spanish class, which is why my Spanish is so bad. But I got really good at it. I could almost touch type on it.
Let's do an update on rodent control at Lyle's house, shall we?
Oh, no.
Yeah. I got to talk about this. So you might recall, if you're a regular listener, that a while ago I was talking about getting rid of rodents and how I had gotten a BB gun and how I was unsuccessfully hunting them. And so I was so proud of myself. And Miles said, "What, you got a cat?" I said, "No, we didn't want a cat because the cat eats birds and we have a lot of birds." So I got traps, rodent traps, rat traps, and we set them. And it was great for a few days until one of the rat traps broke the legs and trapped a bird. So then that wasn't a good idea. So then I went ahead and switched back to trying to get a gun to work. And I've done a lot of things technical and all that to make the gun functional but have been less than successful. On Friday, I decided that it was time for me to really sight at this gun. It has a sight and everything. And so first off, I'm raised in Santa Cruz, so the idea of guns are kind of like bad. And I also
Wait, whoa. I know a lot of people from Santa Cruz that are
I was raised in a hippie commune in Santa Cruz, so guns are bad.
Okay.
In any case, but I've always been interested in guns because I'm a boy in America, and we're trained to do that.
I'm a boy in America. I have no interest. I have absolutely no interest. No, right. Zero interest.
I'm a normal boy in America.
And yeah, I am definitely an abnormal person.
So I'm sighting in this gun, but I'm doing it when my family's away because I don't want my kids to be engaged in guns and all that. And I'm kind of rushing, and I'm multiple firing this, like four sets, get the grouping, check the sights, reset it. Something
this
you do with
doesn't
it.
Sound good.
And I was using my left leg to prop the end of the barrel. It's not a really long barrel. It's an 18-inch gun.
You all see where this is going, don't you?
So at one point, I rested the barrel a little lower than I should have because between me and the target, which, by the way, would have been a perfect bullseye, I know it, the flesh of my leg was in the way. And when I pulled the trigger, the pellet went through my flesh and into my flesh. I shot myself in the leg. So I've now been stabbed, shot. I've broken my back falling out of a tree and head-on collision with a motorcycle. I was a motorcycle head-on collision. I'm basically doing pretty well. I'm not that damaged.
Aside from the pin in your hip.
Nine lives, you have, and the fused vertebrae.
And the limp.
Yeah.
And the embarrassment of saying, yes, I shot myself in the leg.
You're a
the
mess,
fact
man.
That you can't play basketball with me, even if you were any good at it.
Or if I wanted to. I'm just kidding.
Do I need to take you to a gun safety class?
I think it's a little late for that. I took myself on Friday night.
No. It's never too late. If you're going to continue to do this as a hobby,
gun safety. This?
I would actually recommend this for everyone, including you, Ben. Even though you don't have any interest in guns,
I've seen one gun in my life.
I think it's important to know how they're used, how they should be used safely, and how to mitigate potential damage to yourself and people you care about.
Rule number one, the gun is always loaded.
So to keep in mind here, I was fully in control of the weapon. I was fully aiming it and firing it by choice. It wasn't a discharge. I wasn't aiming at anything inappropriate. I just happened to have my flesh in the way of it.
You were fully in control of the weapon.
Yeah. So most gun accidents are a misfire, like firing when you don't intend to. I fully intended to fire at that time.
That's what you mean by in control. Because, I guess. Okay.
It's just that the lack of intelligence derailed me from success. But I think that probably in a training class, Didi, to bring your point, to training class, they would have said, never use your body to rest the end of a barrel.
You know what you would have thought?
Yes.
You would have thought,
of course,
duh, is what you would have.
And then when I was doing the shooting I was doing, I would have had a beanbag on the table and used that instead. And all these.
Yeah. So
right. You never put anything between you and the barrel that you don't want
but
to get
keep
shot.
In mind,
so that would be
I was not aware
yourself, your body, other people.
But keep in mind, I was not aware that the barrel that my flesh was in the way of the barrel.
Well, that, yeah.
So I do want to bring up
you don't use it to prop anything. There are stands
yes.
for that.
Yes, see,
kind of
that's
thing.
The training class that I would have gotten. It's a use a stand.
Yeah. See, this is where I also want to bring up the wonderful statistic, which is a firearm in the house is 13 times more likely to be used on the owner of that weapon, a friend or family member, than it will be on a on a home intruder.
I am living proof of this. It's really interesting. As soon as I shot myself, I went, oh, that's how that happens.
You are now a statistic.
When I fired it, the first thought was the gun has like bounced up and slapped me on the leg. Because, of course, it's instantaneously your nerve endings do not register everything. And then, of course, you go into relatively shock. And then my second thought was, I have to clean this up prior to my wife getting home. So I grab my leg and start putting pressure on it and get into the house and pull up my, you know, get some paper towels. And I'm thinking, can I back the pellet out of my leg? Like, I can feel the pellet. It's like 3.5 centimeters from where it entered my body.
God.
It's along the top of my leg, kind of below my knee. And so I start pushing the pellet back. And, of course, this is when the blood system goes, oh, we should probably bleed now. And so I just started bleeding, and I'm covering that up. Then I hear Maggie's car pull up. That's my wife's name. And she comes into the house, and I go, I might be able to hide this. I already have tweezers, by the way, at this time. I already have tweezers in my hand because I don't remember getting them, but I got tweezers to dig it out. And I look down on the kitchen floor, tiled floor, and it's like a murder scene. There's blood everywhere. I'm like, I think I should probably have help with this. So
Lyle, I want you.
When was your last tetanus shot?
I'm good. Yeah. I just had one Friday night, actually.
I want you to be completely honest with this right now, okay? 5 minutes prior to the incident, if someone asked you, "Are you a responsible gun owner?" What would be your response?
Yeah, I'd say I was responsible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wanted to know.
You want to know how full of it I am? I mean, keep in mind, I'm aware that you never aim a weapon unless you intend to kill that thing, right? You never aim it on anything that you don't want to destroy. That's like a core concept. You always consider it loaded. You always consider it dangerous. And that's how I operate with it. But
it still happens.
It still happens. Mistakes still happen. Mm. By the way, the pellet itself, it was then dug out of my leg by this doctor who was really excited because it was the first gunshot wound. I go to this doc in the box in Scotts Valley, and I come in, and Maggie's already called them, and they go, "Ooh." And we're like, why are you excited? She's like, this is our first gunshot. Like, they're really excited about it. Anyway, for those people that are more aware of weapons, this is an air an air-powered rifle that shoots .22 caliber pellets. So they're larger than the 177. It's the same size as a .22 bullet in diameter. And it's pre-compressed air, so you have to pump it up to 3,000 or 2,500 PSI. And anyway, yeah, they're geeky and fun and dangerous as heck. Oh, by the way, the front of the pellet, which is lead, of course, is one of the reasons why I had to get out of the body and I couldn't hide it from my wife.
Even though you
I totally wanted to because it was so embarrassing. But once I told Maggie what happened and we started doing it, I'm like, you know what? I'm going to be completely public about this. This is completely stupid. I'm a relatively intelligent person. I made a dumb mistake. It is so easy to do that. Thank God it wasn't a .38. Thank God I didn't go through my bone. All these other things that could have been just as easy to do.
Yeah.
And they're really dangerous. And yeah. I was hurrying. Yeah, I was hurrying.
Like, chainsawing on a ladder.
So
there is a pattern here, Lyle.
So the other thing is that the pellet, which I don't have here, but I have on my desk. I'll show you guys in a second. It has a pattern on the front of the lead pellet. It has a bit of a pattern to it. And I thought, that's weird. It's like a texture. It doesn't look like it's flesh texture. What is that? And I finally realized today, it's the texture of my gene material that it had to penetrate. You can actually see the texture of the gene material as it went through.
Wow.
So I'm an idiot. Are we done?
I feel like we need to give you a checklist before you do anything for the rest of your life.
Well, rushing is pretty much – I mean, my motorcycle accident wasn't actually my fault, so that one it wasn't about rushing. But breaking my back, I was rushing. Shooting myself in the leg, I was rushing.
Falling asleep at the wheel?
I was doing too much, which is a form of rushing, right? I forgot that one.
I didn't.
Two head-on collisions.
Luckily, he did not hurt anyone else in that.
That's
regard.
True. That is a good thing.
Yeah.
Hey, yeah, I'm pretty good at not
hurting people. Emphasis on luck, yeah.
And I thought I was accident prone.
Didi, are you a gun collector?
No, I just my ex's family has a whole arsenal. And so I learned from a couple of friends in Ohio. I've shot some really big weapons in Indiana with the family. And some of my coworkers shoot recreationally, so
yeah,
AK-47s are loud and really inaccurate.
Yes. I've done quite a bit of shooting
as
well.
The sights are horrible.
And I have a little bit of training, but actually it's on prop weapons. It's how you deal with a weapon on set, especially when you have blanks and how you manage that. Because when I was in the movie industry, I had to take care of weapons because of
special. You're in the movie
stuff.
Or theater?
Movie, Los Angeles.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Yes. You don't know everything about
me. He wrote Visual Basic for special effects of computer graphics.
And I shot myself in the leg once. I did a movie. I did special effects for a film, and one of those things I had to do, we did second camera. We were walking around L.A. with guns and shooting all these shots, and I had to hold the weapon. At one point, we needed a blank, and so I had to deal with the live weapon, and it was a really interesting process.
Yeah. As a software engineer, it's a good thing that you shot yourself in the leg with a .22 air rifle.
Pistol.
Most programmers will shoot themselves in the leg with C++ and blow the whole leg off.
Oh. Really? What was your programming joke earlier this week? You want to do that too?
The programming joke? Oh, that wasn't my joke. That was Greg Merkley's.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's right. It was my joke, wasn't it? Oh, yeah.
I'm sure you didn't write it.
Okay,
yes.
Yeah. Why do functional programmers homeschool their kids?
Why, Miles? Why do functional programmers homeschool their kids?
Because they hate classes.
Wah, wah.
At which point Brian said, do they need structure? Please enumerate. Mm.
Oh.
And I finally responded with ending out the whole thing with no comment.
Speaking of which, Miles Elam, Ben Jaffe.
Oh, wait.
Dee Hubbard,
No.
More?
No. We have to talk about the Commodore 64 that is still in use.
What's a Commodore 64?
Exactly.
It's an artifact from the 80s.
Something we talk about is that we're always making new stuff and not reusing the thing that works. There's an auto repair shop that was using a Commodore 64 to balance drive shafts.
Seriously?
Yes. And so it's been in service for over 25 years and still going.
Oh.
Okay, first Commodore 64 was released in 1982, January of 1982. Mm-hmm. And then towards the end, I'm trying to scan the 86. It was done.
This computer has survived a flood.
Oh,
94, poop.
Excuse me. My gosh, it was produced until April of 1994.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
There's a lot of documentation for
it. Is it still running?
Yes, it's still going.
That's fantastic.
There are pictures. Go to the website. Look at the pictures.
I had a Commodore VIC-20, which if you thought 64K was not enough, 20 wasn't either. And anytime I was like, yeah, I around the office and stuff, I'll mention that I had a VIC-20. And people are like, what? Like, I'm still cursed by being silly for having that.
The first computer I ever used was an XCD Sorcerer. My dad purchased, and it had 16K of RAM. Mm-hmm. At which point, my dad spent, I forget how, like hundreds of dollars to get the upgrade to 32K of RAM. Hundreds of dollars.
All right. Any other follow-up stories besides Miles?
My first PC was an IBM PC Junior.
Aw, that's adorable. Hey, wait. Ben, when were you born?
I'm not saying that.
Were you out of 90? Were you out of 82 or 80s, 1980s?
Was I out of?
Were you born in the 90s or the 80s?
80s.
Okay. And you were kidding. You knew what a Commodore 64 was.
Yeah, I did. Yeah, of course. God. It's just dry. How old do you think I am?
Did you know what an XCD Sorcerer was?
A sorcerer?
XCD Sorcerer.
Yeah, I know what sorcerers are.
I don't know
They're
what an
like
XCD
wizards.
Sorcerer is either.
It was a Z80 sometimes. Machine. Do you know what a Z80 is?
Z80?
tell us.
It's a processor.
Yeah. Is it the predecessor to the 8080?
No.
No?
No.
No relation?
No. Before the Intel processors took over with regard to the PC industry, processors didn't – there were so many different families of processors. You got a computer and you had to code it most of the time in assembly language, and maybe if you had a compiler and you had C if you were lucky. Hmm. But for the most part, you had a basic interpreter or you had the assembly language and an assembler to write with. And each processor had its own assembly language, had its own register set, its own, you know, its own operators.
And there weren't uniform higher-level programming languages like C to help you merge the gap.
There were. It depends upon the processor. Depends upon how much support. Because, like I said, it was very much a cutter's industry. You had these one-off processors everywhere. So making a whole compiler set for it was usually out of the question. BASIC was the common lingua franca for a lot of these hobbyist machines.
It's because BASIC is awesome.
Because you just had to write the BASIC interpreter once.
And how do you remember that when I was doing film stuff in Los Angeles, I was using Visual Basic? How do you possibly remember that? I told you at one point?
Well, you know me. I never forget anything.
Yeah, you do.
I have excellent long-term memory. My short-term memory is selective.
I forgot that I wrote that in BASIC.
I would call you an elephant, except you're really not into Republicanism.
I feel like asking you questions about my life.
Well, I would say elephant is actually more PostgreSQL, and I am into that, so that's fair.
Oh, jeez. You know, a few minutes ago when you were going off about the processors and memory space and all that, I thought this would be so awesome to just fade this out as the show closes. That's why I was smiling while you were talking. I was just imagining rambling you slowly out.
Ramble on.
Anything else?
Ramble on like a Trump at a presidential debate.
We've been
sing my song. Ramble on.